Hi, everybody. Great to have you with us. This is The Takeaway. I'm Arun Venugopal, filling in for Tanzina Vega today. We're about midway through June, the month known as Pride. That is, of course, because of an event that took place 50 years ago, just up the street from our studios here at WNYC. On June 28th, 1969, the New York City Police Department raided the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in downtown Manhattan. Officers physically and verbally harassed the patrons of the bar and performed invasive checks on some of the gender non-conforming patrons. The patrons fought back, and the clashes lasted for 6 days. Last week, a half century later, New York City Police Commissioner James O'Neill took the step of formally apologizing for the NYPD's actions at Stonewall.
The actions taken by the NYPD were wrong, plain and simple. The actions and the laws were discriminatory and oppressive, and for that, I apologize.
I don't expect that an apology is going to heal all of the wounds or will suddenly reverse all of the mistrust that members of the community have towards law enforcement, but it's a step in the right direction. It's a piece of the puzzle.
And that is?
Greg Moralia. I'm a career veteran member of law enforcement and have been teaching in law enforcement at the Law Enforcement Academy in Napa for 33 years.
Things are different now than they were 3 decades ago.
When I walked in the door at age 15 in 1978 to the first police department I worked for, I heard the words, "Don't be gay, queer," in a very derogatory way immediately. So the culture and the environment there signaled to me right away that there was no way that I could be out.
But in 2004, Greg did come out, and he says the experience was pretty positive. Today, he helps lead LGBTQ anti-bias training for several departments around the country. And he says that while the NYPD's apology for Stonewall is not going to suddenly make things right between the LGBTQ community and the police, it is a step in the right direction.
And I think it goes in hand with the effort that police departments are making in terms of showcasing their LGBT members by participating in Pride celebrations, having booths, recruiting booths at LGBT Pride celebrations. It's all a part of the effort that needs to take place to build that trust.
Building trust. Police departments all across the country are trying to do that work, but many are still falling short. In a 2014 survey of queer people and people living with HIV conducted by the LGBT rights group Lambda Legal, over 70% of respondents said they had interacted directly with police officers in the past 5 years. More than a fifth of those respondents described those interactions as hostile. People of color and transgender people reported even higher levels of negative interactions in the survey. So let's talk about it. I have two guests with me now who've been studying the relationship between LGBTQ people and the police. Matteo Della Torre is a racial and economic justice policy advocate for the National Center for Transgender Equality. Thanks for being here, Matteo.
Thank you for having me.
And Andrea Ricci is a police misconduct attorney and co-author of Queer Injustice, the Criminalization of LGBT People in the United States. Andrea, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start with you, Andrea. Coming as it did 50 years after the events at Stonewall, how meaningful is an apology from the police commissioner here in New York?
I'm sorry to say not particularly meaningful, given that not much has changed 50 years later. While the laws and policies might have changed, LGBT people's experiences of policing and police abuse and criminalization are largely the same, especially for the LGBT communities who led the Stonewall Uprising, homeless LGBT people, trans LGBT people, LGBT people of color. And that's true even in the very area where the Stonewall Inn is located. The Civilian Complaint Review Board in New York City put out a study in 2016 finding the highest rates of complaints of discrimination and abuse by police officers based on sexual orientation and gender identity took place in that very neighborhood. And in my experience of litigating police misconduct and working with police departments across the country and organizers across the country, many of the very same patterns of abuse that drove that raid and that uprising continue to this day unabated, whether under the same laws or under different laws. And so things might be different for white gay men like Greg, who are police officers, but they're not different for the very communities that led the Stonewall Uprising and who were targeted and continue to be targeted by police officers.
So, Andrea, what are some of the most common forms of harassment that LGBTQ people report in their dealings with the police?
Things range everything from verbal harassment and name calling, which was the sort of number one complaint that the Civilian Complaint Review Board in New York City received, to being misgendered as a trans person. The gender searches that you described at the Stonewall Inn continue to this day. In fact, I filed a lawsuit in 2005 arguing that the NYPD has a pattern and practice of engaging in those gender searches. It led to sweeping policy changes, which at the time were some of the most progressive in the country. But what experience has revealed is that those policy changes are only as good as the paper they're written on if the department is not committed to enforcing them, to training officers on them, and holding them accountable for violating them. And I have since represented a number of trans and gender nonconforming people who have experienced the exact same gender searches, sexual assaults, physical assault, criminalization, profiling, and targeting by law enforcement officers that sort of drove those policy changes in the first place. And the New York City Office of Inspector General recently confirmed that the department hadn't trained most of its officers on it and certainly wasn't making sure that they knew the policies and practices that had been negotiated by the LGBT community and were enforcing them. So the reality is that, you know, while police officers, maybe at Pride, which is something that many members of the LGBT community very much object to, given the long history and continuing history of abuse and violence, essentially, we've put a rainbow flag on the exact same kinds of police policies and practices, from verbal abuse, name calling, gender searches, strip searches. LGBT people experience some of the highest rates of physical violence by law enforcement officers, highest rates of sexual violence and extortion by law enforcement officers, and profiling and criminalization. And that's reflected in the population, in the incarcerated population as well. The same study you referred to by Lambda Legal shows that LGBT people experience 5 times the rate of incarceration of the general population. Other studies have shown that 42% of people incarcerated in women's prison identified as lesbian, bisexual, or gender nonconforming before they were incarcerated. That's not our representation in the general population. I may wish it was, but it's not. And while we all know that 1 in 3 Black men experience incarceration in their lifetime, many of us don't know that 1 in 2 Black trans women will experience incarceration in their lifetime. And those statistics are the product of the very same policing practices that drove the uprising at Stonewall and in so many other places around the country over the years. And the last thing I would say is that the kinds of rating of establishments, of queer establishments, of LGBT establishments, may be something also that we think has stopped. And in fact, that continues. On the 40th anniversary of Stonewall Uprising, there was a raid on the Rainbow Lounge in Dallas, which was very similar to the Stonewall experience. There was a raid in the Eagle Bar in Atlanta the same year, 40 years after Stonewall. I represented 2 women who were beaten by police during a raid of a gay bar in Brooklyn in 2009 and called slurs while they were being beaten by the police. So literally the same things that happened at Stonewall continue to happen to this day.
Now, Mateo, I'd like to bring you into this, too. You published a report earlier this year that looked at the transgender policies of 25 different police departments across the country. What were some of the departments you looked at, and how many of them had clear transgender policies to begin with?
Yeah, thank you. So we looked at the largest 25 police departments, and that included the NYPD, the LAPD, Chicago PD, San Diego PD, and a handful of other departments. And what we found was not surprising. We actually used a model policy that was primarily developed by Andrea Ritchie to see how these departments' policies were measuring up against what we considered would be best practices, right? And what we found is that, first of all, most of these departments ended up not having most or any of these policies in place at all. But one of the most stark findings for me, at least, was that the departments that did have policies on how to respectfully use somebody's name and pronouns, how to respectfully ask for that, how to not perform invasive searches on transgender people to determine their genitalia or quote-unquote their real sex or their real identity, we found that none of these departments required any form of training on the policies that they did have. So even if a department had everything perfect in policy, they weren't necessarily preparing their officers. And we did a quick estimate, and it seems like there's 117,000 officers under these 25 largest police departments across the country, and the NYPD has around 38,000 of those. So these departments are just simply not preparing their officers to go off and engage with every single member of their community. And based on all the statistics and experiences that we know that Andrea mentioned, and based on what we know from the U.S. Transgender Survey, that 58% of transgender respondents were mistreated, and that does include part of what Andrea was talking about verbal harassment. But it goes as far to talk about folks experiencing being forced to engage in sexual activity to avoid arrest. So we know that these departments are just simply not preparing their officers to go off and engage respectfully with the transgender community.
And given the high levels of mistrust, according to your own organization, 57% of respondents were uncomfortable calling the police for help. What are the consequences of that mistrust?
Yeah, so we know that transgender people are just extremely vulnerable to being victimized just on their daily lives. And that includes by the police. I mean, there's, I think, one in three black transgender women has an officer assume that they're a sex worker just because of being who they are and walking down the street. And it becomes increasingly difficult. There's currently a bill in California, SB 233, that will create a safe space for, in theory, create a safe space for sex workers to be able to come in and report violent crime against them or come forward as witnesses of a number of violent crimes without fearing being arrested for engaging in the sex trade. For example, transgender people, a lot of transgender people end up in survival work, and that includes the drug trade, and that includes sex work. And a lot of the times, it's not as a main form of employment, right? It's not out of their choice. It's because these are the few avenues that are available to them due to a whole factor of discrimination. And when you don't necessarily feel comfortable going to the police for help, who do you go to when the police are the people that are terrorizing you, the people that are victimizing you? And especially when you go in and looking at this report, there's just a severe lack of civilian oversight across the country when the department itself is responsible for holding its officers accountable. It makes it less likely that anybody would be, specifically transgender people and transgender people of color, will be able to find justice.
Mateo, what are some policy changes you want to see more police departments adopt?
Yeah, I want departments to stop policing the sex trade. Some of our most vulnerable people in the transgender community are sex workers, and they are just being continually victimized and by law enforcement and not being able to find the few avenues of income that provide food for their table, that keep a roof over their head, and allow for them to continue existing and moving forward with their transitions. So that's one big thing that I want them to do. And specifically in New York, you know, we know that the Decrim New York just introduced a sex work decriminalization bill, and there should be a lot of attention being paid to that, and there should be overwhelming support from every single member of the community for that. Another thing is I want folks to start respecting the identities of transgender people. I have heard countless stories from transgender people where their ID doesn't necessarily match their gender identity, either in their name or their gender marker. And that is an opportunity where officers usually take the opportunity to let everybody know in the near area that this person is a transgender person. That means that they don't really understand the dangers that they're putting this one individual in. I asked one police officer, what are you doing to protect sex workers? And their response was, yeah, sex work is a real problem. You know, they're down on that street. And it seemed like the culture of this conversation and around transgender people in general and sex workers was that they were not the type of person that deserved to be protected by that department. And that just says a lot about the culture in these departments. People think that they've never met a transgender person, and that is a lie. Transgender people exist in every area of life, whether we are out and visible or whether we're not. We are in those communities. We have transgender police officers. And the fact that the law enforcement community hasn't been more proactive in educating themselves on the needs and services that need to be provided for transgender people, it's just significantly overdue.
So you mentioned transgender police officers. I'm curious about how you view police participation in pride events, say. That's often met with a certain amount of resistance. This is what Greg Moralia had to say about that.
If you believe that one of the ideas around pride and pride celebrations is promoting inclusion, acceptance, and equality, then excluding any members of the community from participating and being part of that message makes you a hypocrite. I also don't believe that excluding LGBT members of law enforcement from participating in a pride parade in uniform is going to have any fix at all of the current concerns that people have about things like police use of force.
Andrea, how do you view the participation of law enforcement in pride parades?
I believe uniform law enforcement has no place in a pride parade for exactly the reasons that we've been talking about, is that their relationship, they make people literally feel unsafe at pride. And for many years, I was legal support for people of color organizations participating in pride in New York City. And the amount of violence by law enforcement during pride towards LGBT people of color made their participation make many people feel unsafe. It didn't, literally, there was a disconnect between, you know, the rainbow banner float at the front and the cops beating people at the back. And there's no place. I think that the concerns that Greg is raising are better addressed by actually changing the behavior of the police department in the ways that Teo is talking about than sort of, as I said, slapping a rainbow flag on it once a year and coming to Pride and making most people who are participating in Pride feel actually more unsafe, not more safe.
Has there been visible change in the number, the representation of LGBT members of police forces in New York or elsewhere?
I think there has been, certainly in terms of the number of out police officers, but I think as we've seen with other communities, that doesn't change the behavior. I think we've seen an increase in the number of police officers of color, and we still see rampant police violence against Black and brown communities. We've seen increased numbers of police officers who are immigrants and rampant police violence against migrant communities and so forth. So I think, again, it's not about representation. It's about changed behavior. And I think that as long as police departments are trying to look good on paper and maybe sort of pinkwashing their department while continuing to engage in the same behavior, then I don't think we're actually moving forward. And that's the key. And I think that ultimately, in response to the question that you posed to Mateo, I think that there has to be concrete changes in behavior. And if there can't be, which has been our experience over the past 50 years, whether police are responding to LGBT people on the street or responding to them when they're calling for help, which in Atlanta, a study by the Solutions Not Punishment Coalition found that in 38% of cases where trans women called for help from the police, they were arrested instead. There are cases like Kai Peterson's in Georgia, where he was a Black trans man who was sexually assaulted, defended himself, and was convicted of a crime for defending himself because the police officers literally say, "You don't look like a rape victim to us." So when that kind of behavior is still going on, at this point, we need to come up with different responses so that we can actually protect trans and gender nonconforming people from the epidemic of violence that they're experiencing in the absence of police protection and in the form of police violence as primary kind of perpetrators of violence against trans communities. And we have to come up with other ways to respond to homelessness, to people in mental health crisis, to all the situations in which LGBT people come into contact with the police. And I definitely want to lift up what Mateo was saying around decriminalization of prostitution. There's also a campaign in D.C. as something that is not only necessary to stop criminalization of LGBT people, but also to save lives. And folks may have heard of Lailene Polanco, a trans woman who died in Rikers in police custody last week. And her original charge was for both prostitution and possession of drug paraphernalia. So we need to decriminalize, stop the war on drugs. We need to decriminalize prostitution to save lives like Lailene's.
Andrea Ritchie is co-author of Queer Injustice, the Criminalization of LGBT People in the United States. And Matteo Della Torre is a racial and economic justice policy advocate for the National Center for Transgender Equality. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Juliana Antoninus. I'm calling from Brooklyn. I am a trans woman, and I've had very, very bad experiences with the NYPD. Pretty much every time I interact with them, they misgender me. This includes the time that I called 911 to report a gunshot on the street outside my window. They called me and repeatedly misgendered me when I was reporting that.
I don't have any problems with the police because I don't present as anything particularly LGBTQ. They can't look at me and tell that I'm bi and polyamorous, so I don't have any problems with them.
LGBTQ listeners, we want to hear about your experiences with police. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm Arun Venugopal, filling in for Tanzina. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.